Good evening. Welcome. If you want to scooch around a little closer, you're certainly welcome. Come on in.
I'm good.
So I want to start by tonight. Most of you have met me before. I'll introduce myself. My name is Aliza Bulow. I live in Denver, Colorado. I teach Torah in Denver and around the country and in Israel, Canada, Mexico. Those are my countries so far. Haven't really taught Torah and past that, but hopefully I'll keep adding to the list. Tonight, I want to tell you a story, an amazing story with lessons woven throughout. But I want to start first by acknowledging my first Torah teacher that I ever had, and that is Mrs. Bernice Lynch Gwertz. So I really appreciate the contribution that Bernice made to my life in hosting me in my early quest before I was Jewish and searching, and she took care of me every week. We made Shabbos dinner together and went to shul together, and she's the one who taught me. I was so interested in the rabbi's sermon one time that I took out a notepad and a pen, and she said, "You're not allowed to in a synagogue on the Sabbath." So I learned so much, and she was really the beginning of my journey, really my first teacher. So I appreciate it very much. So it's very special. I'm so glad that you're here tonight. So thank you for coming. And I also want to acknowledge my host, Luna Jaffe, for hosting me here in Denver and taking care of my mother so much. And she's my leap sister, because our parents were connected but not married. So it's further than a step. It's a leap. But she's my leap sister. So, and I appreciate your hosting. So thank you very much. And who's the person? Where did you go? The one who arranged this. Thank you for arranging this for tonight. Where'd she go? She's not here yet, right? Yeah, she's not. So anyway, thank you to everybody who had a hand in arranging it. Okay, the story that I want to share with you tonight, which has lessons woven throughout, and you don't have to just listen. You're welcome to ask questions and jump right in. But I want to share with you the story of my daughter's shidduch, my daughter's engagement. And there's a story after that too, so that the end is not the end. The end is the middle. But in order to understand that story, you have to understand a little bit about me. So I converted to Judaism at 16. I went to Israel at 16. I spent 4 years there. I studied in Ravina's yeshiva. I served in the army. I met my husband in Israel. We came back to the States. And I was always on an upward trajectory. I wanted to be as Jewish as I could be. So, in fact, that's why I went to Camp Salman Schechter here, because the rabbi gave a sermon about how important summer camp is and the summer camp experience and how all grandparents should empower their grandchildren to go to camp. And if you want your kids to be Jewish forever, then they should go to Camp Salman Schechter. And I thought to myself, I want to be Jewish forever. I should go to Camp Salman Schechter. So I earned the money, and I decided that would be my experimental, see if I could pass. You know, I went to camp when I was 15, and I loved it. And so that's a whole long and other story, but it's important to know that for this story. So for this story, so I was on my trajectory. I started out in the conservative community, moved into the modern Orthodox community, the Mizrahi community in Israel. And then from Israel, came back to the States, kind of back in the modern world a little bit, but continued learning strong. I loved to learn. And I slowly moved into the Haredi world, or what's called the ultra-Orthodox. I would call myself Haredi eclectic today. So I still put myself in that Haredi world, but it's definitely eclectic. But in my, as I was moving into that world, I knew that the way I wanted my children to get married would be different than the way I wanted to get, why I got married. So I wanted them to participate in the shidduch system, the matchmaking system, the assisted arranged system. So when my eldest, I have six children, born in 7.5 years. So when my eldest, Elisheva, at 4, asked me, "Ima, who will I marry?" I told her, "Don't worry. When you're old enough to get married, I will find just the right boy for you." Thinking in my conceit as a young mother and relatively newly Haredi Jew, that I'd be able to do that when the time came. So the years pass, and I send them to the rightest of wing schools, a sign on the dotted line, no TV school. We don't have a TV in the home, and they're listening to lots of tapes and learning all the things that they learn from those Torah tapes, and I'm learning along with them. And we go to the bungalow colonies in the Catskills for 6 summers, and my mother even comes with us for three of those summers, where she was affectionately known as Bubby Bulow, even though in the rest of the world she's Grandma Orally. But in the bungalow, she was Bubby Bulow. And I became very acculturated in the Haredi world, and that's where I learned to speak yeshiva speak. And I'm sending my daughters, you know, to these right-wing schools, and the sons also. And my husband's a Manhattan lawyer, which makes us a little different kind of family, because most of their friends' families, the girls' friends' families, their fathers were rebbes. The boys went to a different school. Their friends' families, the fathers were professional. But for my daughters, it was a little bit hard for them. They were going to school in Far Rockaway. We lived in Long Beach, Long Island. And especially my eldest really took to the whole thing very nicely. All the girls really did. They're nice, solid, firm girls, religious girls. So we moved to Denver about 10 years ago when my eldest was a freshman in high school. After her freshman year, she started her sophomore year there. She graduates Beis Yaakov. And now she's ready to go to seminary, right? So the day of her graduation, she came home and she said, "Ima, I don't know what to do." She said, "I don't know. Am I allowed to listen to the Chevra or not?" The Chevra is, we only listen to it at that time. It's a little different now. She was the oldest then. At that time, we only listened to Jewish music in the house or classical music. That was it. They couldn't figure out how I knew all the supermarket songs, which I did, because it's all the radio songs of my youth, and why I still like Stevie Wonder, but we only listened to Jewish music and classical music in the house. But the Chevra is Jewish music with a strong beat. And so it wasn't considered appropriate for the girls in her circle, right? That was what the boys listened to and not the girls. So she's asking me, like, is she allowed to listen to it or not? It's Jewish. She's confused. It's Jewish, but it's a little strong beat. Can she listen to it? So me being me, I'm starting to realize that there is this culture gap. Like, I've achieved raising her the way I wanted her to be raised, and yet I'm not really the mom of that kind of a child, right? She is a different creature than I am, and there was a strong culture gap that I was beginning to see. So I told her, I said, "Elisheva, you just graduated from high school. So now the era of black and white is over, and the era of gray has begun." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well," I said, "you could listen to music, Jewish music and non-Jewish music, and see how it makes you feel. If it makes you feel kosher, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish, you're allowed to listen to it. If it makes you feel treif, if it's Jewish or non-Jewish, you shouldn't listen to it. If it makes you feel pariv, you could listen to it." She said, "What do you mean by pariv?" I said, "Well," now here, showing my age, I don't really know the modern groups. So I said, "You could try listening to Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or The Carpenters, or John Denver, and see if you like it." And she said, "John Denver, doesn't he sing love songs?" I said, "Yes, he does." She said, "Well, I don't know if I could listen to love songs." I said, "Elisheva, you're 18 now. Now you're allowed to listen to love songs." So this is a girl who is very careful. She had been taught in school to guard her eyes and guard her ears, and she did not watch movies. There are some, we don't have a TV in the house, but we unfortunately have internet. And at that time, there wasn't Netflix yet, but there was, you know, on computers you could watch DVDs, and slowly, slowly more movies did start creeping into our home. But she was very careful. She did not watch them. She's not a movie watcher, not the type. So, okay, off she goes to seminary, and she comes back from a year in seminary, and all revved up, as they do to them in seminary in Israel, ready to go. And she comes back, she says, "Okay, I'm ready to get married. Now it's time for you to find me the guy." I'm like, "Oh, okay." She's 19 and she's ready to get married, which I knew was there, but now I had to find the guy. And now I realize my inadequacy. Okay, so now I realize, how am I supposed to find a guy for her? And not just that, but I grew up enough in the firm community now to know that she's on the blacklist. She has a convert for a mother and a lawyer for a father, and we're not rich. Okay, so that's like, strike, 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 right? And she's tall. okay, no good. So I'm thinking, how am I going to find just the right match for this perfect girl? She's tznius, she's modest, she loves to go to Kever Rachel, Rachel's tomb. She went there once a week, usually, in the Kotel once a week. And she's really, she prays with intent, she davens with kavanah, she's really like very, and she's careful about what she, and she wants to marry a Ben Torah. Okay, she wants to marry somebody who will be in learning. Now, we are not rich, right? But my husband's an attorney, so we had been working with her for years on this Ben Torah thing, right? We want her to marry a Ben Torah, but we want her to marry a Ben Torah who will also bring income into the house, so it won't be her that's paying for everything. So, and yet, she's been in the right-wing schools where she knows that the right thing to do is to get her master's degree and support her husband and have 10 kids and be very modest and stay in the house and try to have an in-house-based business so that her, and then never disturb her husband from the Gemara. So he should be able to learn full-time, she should earn full-time and raise all the children and not disturb him and keep a perfect house. So that's her intent, right? And she wants me to find the guy for this project. Okay. So I start to insist that it would be nice if this guy could earn a living too, or if at least he had a plan, or maybe some college under his belt, so like it wouldn't be so far to finish it, so he would be able to earn an income too, be able to participate in that program. She's telling me how I don't understand, I'm telling her how she doesn't understand, but we do actually come to some kind of agreement that, yeah, there should be some type of income. And I realize that there's no way with us, the way that we are, eclectically religious. My husband teases me that we're modern Orthodox because he's modern and I'm Orthodox. So there's a little bit of a spread between us. But I realized she's not going to get the guy she wants coming from our family. I needed to send her back to Israel. And anyway, back in Israel, she could finish college faster than in the States. So off she goes for a second year in Israel. Comes back after the second year, new Ima. She's really ready. But I hadn't found anybody for her yet. So I sent her off for a third year. Off for the third year she goes, and now I am starting to look. I'm calling shadchans, I'm calling matchmakers, and I'm making the inquiries, and I'm checking it out, and I write her a shidduch resume. This is a thing that you need to write in the Orthodox world. Now, one thing that I didn't know is that there's two types of shidduch resumes. There's Baal Tshuva shidduch resumes, and there's FFB, from birth shidduch resumes. So the Baal Tshuva ones have like a paragraph about who you are and a paragraph about what you're looking for, and then it'll say the schools that you attended, your family, your siblings, and references at the bottom. The Frum ones do not have that. No paragraph describing anything. Who needs descriptions when you know who you are? So you just put your name and your parents, the shul you go to, your siblings, if they're married or not, where the school, maybe a school that they went to, especially if it's impressive, and then the schools you went to and your references. That's it. There's no other information, no extraneous information. Now, even though she's religious from birth, I'm not. So I write her the BT type, turns out, the Baal Tshuva type. Right? So I have the little paragraph about who she is, and I talk about how she's, very modest, and she also has a sense of adventure, because we have done lots of camping and mountain climbing and things like that, and she enjoyed that kind of stuff. She's my partner in that as the oldest one in the family, and my husband being the attorney, so he would stay in the office, and the two of us would take the kids and go. So she definitely had a sense of adventure. So I put that in there, and she's musical, and, I wanted that, too. Like, it wasn't a deal breaker if he wouldn't be musical, but it would be nice if he was musical, so I put that in there, too. Great. Okay, so I'm circulating her shidduch resume, and I get some phone calls, and I also get some no's when they find out that I converted. They weren't interested in that. But I do get some phone calls, and I start to make some matches, and she goes on a date here or a date there, and usually it's one. You can say no after one. Two means you're a little bit interested, so she went on a few two dates, and she didn't really get to a third, except for once or twice. One person she went out with seven times. Seven times is like you're engaged already, and practically, right? So seven times is a lot. So, but she after the third one, after the fourth one, she just wasn't feeling a click. So I went to a dating coach, and I talked to the dating coach about, what should they do? They're not feeling a click, but they've gone out four times. It's really, you should be getting engaged at that point. So, she said, if she's not feeling a reason to say no, she just doesn't feel a reason to say yes, tell her to go again and go again. And then she said, to get them to try to compliment each other. Like she should say something nice about his tie. Whenever, right? Okay, so, okay, we give that advice. It just, it's not working. They go out another, I think, nine times altogether, and just, it just did not click. Okay, that ended. And she told me, Ima, I hate dating. I never want to date again. I totally trust you. Just find the guy and tell me who he is, and I'll marry him. So, right, that, right, total responsibility, right? So I said, I'm sorry. I actually can't do that for you. We're not Hasidish. I'm not capable of really finding the guy just like that and telling you who he is. All I can do is vet the guy. You'll have to meet him, see if there's a click, and then you'll decide. But I can't, like, just pick the guy for you. She's like, Ima, I hate dating so much. So she comes home that summer, and then she's off going back to Israel for a fourth year. Meanwhile, she gets on the plane, and that night I sit down at a wedding with an acquaintance from across town, somebody who's like really older than I am, but not a whole generation older than I am. But so I'm friends with her married eldest, who's younger than I am, but not a full generation, right? So he's in his 30s, I'm in my 40s, and we're friends with that younger couple, and I'm sitting with his mom. So she's telling me about how her oldest one, who I know is married, and the middle one, off to Israel for, is about to go to Israel for his fifth year of learning. And the youngest one is going to be going to Israel for his first year of learning. So this will be her first empty nest year. She's telling me all her projects and plans, everything she's going to do with her empty nest time. She's excited, right? And we had a very nice connection that night. The next morning, I hear that there has been a terrible car accident. Her middle son, who was about to head back to Israel for his fifth year of learning, was a camp counselor in a wilderness camp, was driving 12 campers in a 15-passenger van with four canoes behind it up to Bangor, Maine, and drove off the highway, rolled the van. Everybody was injured. One camper was killed, and they didn't know what would happen. He was in a coma, and they had airlifted him to the hospital in Maine. And they were trying to wake him up enough to see what the damage would be, but clearly it was bad. They weren't sure if he was going to make it. So I'm thinking about the time I spent with her last night. Like, we're not friends, you know, but we were friendly, and I'm friends with her children. So should I call? Shouldn't I call? Like, it's a terrible tragedy, but I knew she needed this space, too. I just didn't know what to do. And off she flies to Maine to see what's left of her son. And Tehillim groups immediately form, and everybody's saying psalms across the country, really, and in Israel, too. And people are davening and davening and davening, and we don't know what's going to happen. And it turns out he does make it, but he has a spinal cord injury. And they're not sure if he'll be completely paralyzed, if he'll be able to breathe on his own. They just don't know. But after 10 days in intensive care in Maine, they fly him on a special medevac flight to Denver, where one of the premier spinal cord injury hospitals of the country is, fortunately, and that's where he's from. So he's airlifted to Denver to begin a 100-day hospital stay. So now they set up one of these websites, you know, everybody cares kind of website, so you can see the updates, and they start sending out like little updates. He opened his eyes today. He started to be able to breathe on his own today. We're cutting back on the pain meds so that maybe he could start talking, you know, at some point. We still don't know if there's cognitive damage, and then they, you know, he wakes up enough that they're clear that there's not cognitive damage. And meanwhile, I'm still torn up. Like, I send her emails, if you need anything, I'm here. But I didn't call her. Like, should I? Shouldn't I? I just didn't know. And then I was thinking to my own self, like, is this my own fear? Am I really, is it about me giving her space, or is it me not wanting to be in her pain? I don't know. You know, it was a very confusing thing. But finally, in response to one of the emails that I sent, they sent out an email saying, actually, we need a break. We need somebody to spend Shabbos in the hospital so we can go home and have a break. So I sent an email right away and said, I am available for Shabbos. It was, that semester was just me and my husband and our youngest. Everybody else was somewhere that semester. So I said, for sure, we'll be there. We'll spend Shabbos in the hospital. So great, it's arranged. We're going to spend Shabbos in the hospital. I do all the cooking, bring everything, and I did a dry run early in the day to make sure I could find his room and find the hospital, where I'm going to set everything up, see everything. I walk into the room, and he's in an electric wheelchair tipped all the way up with his knees up. Like, I'm nervous to walk in the room and see this very injured person. And they had done surgeries, and he is already, you know, recovering from some surgeries, but I didn't know what it would be like. So I go in, his knees are tipped away up, his head is way down, and I walk in, and he looked at me. I had only met him once, just in passing in a ski lodge. Like, hey, I'm Ari's brother. Hey, nice to meet you. That was it. So I walk in, and he said, what's up? And I said, your knees, I guess. And then I thought, well, that was really stupid. Yeah. What did I say? that? I didn't know what to say. Like, so then he makes himself move back down in the power chair, and his knees weren't up anymore. And I'm like, hi, I'm Elisa Buell. I'm coming for Shabbos. He's like, okay, great, coming for Shabbos. And he was out of breath just from saying that. And I said, that's, you know, such an interesting electric chair you have there. He said, we call them power chairs because electric chair has a bad connotation. I'm like, right, a power chair. Yeah, great power chair. So great. I leave. I come back with all the food, my husband, my son. And fortunately, one of Yehoshua's friends had flown in from Lakewood to spend Shabbos with him also, so it wasn't as intense a time, just us and him, because we had to feed him. He couldn't use his hands at that time, so we had to feed him. I held the sitter for him, for him to daven. I turned the pages. I felt like, you know, when people turn the pages for a pianist, you know, I was turning the pages as I was listening to him daven. But even having him daven in a whisper, he was getting out of breath. It was hard for him to speak and breathe at the same time. His core muscles were so weak. But I saw he was really making an effort, and we had a nice Shabbos, and my husband's great at telling jokes and putting everybody at ease, and it was a nice Shabbos. And when we left, I was much more comfortable with him, and a few weeks later, he asked for us to come back. So we went back, and that time it was just the three of us and him, and we were comfortable enough, and we had a nice time. And that week was the Torah portion of Yaakov's fight with the angel. And so I love Rav Hirsch. I like to read Rav Hirsch's commentaries, and I had brought my Rav Hirsch Chumash to the hospital. And so I'm reading about the fight, and I'm reading about the Gid Hanasha, the sciatic nerve, that we don't eat until this very day because the angel injured Yaakov in his leg. And so Rav Hirsch asks, is it possible that we don't eat that nerve because of a fight long in history between one angel and one person, and for that reason, to commemorate one fight, we don't eat the hind quarter of the animal forever? Is that it? Is that what's going on? He said, no, that's not what's going on. What's going on is the angel injured Yaakov in his leg. And so Yaakov / Yisrael, the Jews, forever limp into history. So the image of him limping forward, he says the reason that we don't eat it is to teach us that our stability is not in our legs. We are not physically stable as a people. We do limp into history. And our strength is not physically based. And our stability is not physical. Our strength and our power is intellectual and spiritual. And that's what we need to emphasize and rely on, not our physical strength. We are not a people of physical prowess. We're a people of intellectual and spiritual gifts. That's why we don't eat the sciatic nerve. So I thought, that's pretty amazing. Right here, this parsha in this hospital room with this boy with weak legs or no legs. I mean, he still had them attached, but they weren't working at all. So I read it to him. And I see that he loves to learn. And he's a yeshiva bacher. He was going back to the Mir for a fifth year. Right? So the Mir is one of the top premier institutions. And here I am, a chutzpahdik young, you know, not so young, but a chutzpahdik female Torah scholar. I'm not a Torah scholar. I just love to learn, right? So, and I'm busy telling this mirror boy my piece of Torah. But I thought it was an apropos piece of Torah, and I wanted to share it with him. And he enjoyed it. He appreciated it. And I see that he wants to learn, but he can't hold a book. Although now it's getting a little better. At this point, he could pick up like something bigger. He doesn't have all his fingers used like that, but he could pick up something like that. So he was able to pick up a chip or pick up a cookie to eat, but he still couldn't hold a book. He didn't have that strength yet. And I had learned with Rabbi Jonathan Reddy, a memory technique of how to create file folders in your head and file all your information, file all the different chapters of the Torah in that so that you could access that information and review and learn without a book in front of you. Now, I haven't applied it to the entire Torah. I just have it for the first book. But I learned the system, and I decided I wanted to teach it to him. So I said, Yehoshua, I want to teach you a system where you're going to be able to learn from books that you know that are on the shelf, but you'll be able to get them into your mind through the system. I said, I want to make a chavrusa with you. He said, oh, you want a chavrusa with me? I said, yep, I do. He said, okay, I don't have the ability right now. I don't have enough psychic energy to pay attention to it while I'm still healing like this, but when I get out of the hospital and I go back to yeshiva, let's make a chavrusa. So the yeshiva is close to my house. So when he got out of the hospital, Oh, that after that Shabbos, when I chatted with him, I thought, you know, he's such a nice guy. Really too bad he's a quadriplegic, because he's like kind of what my daughter's looking for. Like, he's really spiritual, he loves to daven, and he loves to learn. Not because it's the cool thing, not because it's the in thing, not because he doesn't know what else to do, because he loves Torah. He loves it. But he's a quadriplegic, so forget about it. And meanwhile, I had my eye on his friend who had flown in. And I thought, and the friend is so kind, and he's so nice, and look, he flew to see his friend, and he also likes to learn. They're learning, you know, he sings Semiros nicely, you know, so I'll have my eyes on the friend. Something, and maybe if I make friends with Yeshua, I'll be able to have him call the friend, and we'll talk. So, meanwhile, I start this chavrusa with Yeshua, and I see he's slowly recovering a little more and a little more. It seems pretty clear that he will be a quadriplegic. Quadriplegic means all four limbs are affected by paralysis. It doesn't mean you can't move at all, but it means they're all affected by paralysis. So in his case, from the waist down, he has no sensation at all, except maybe sometimes cold from the inside, but not from the outside. No breeze, no pressure, nothing from the waist down. But his arms can move. Not all directions, but they can move. And his fingers are kind of funny looking, kind of like that. But he can pick up a cup. He could drink like this, but he can't do this motion. And it turns out, I learned a lot about how quadriplegics work. The injury also caused him to not be able to sweat at all, which means no moisture on the tips of your fingers even to be able to hold a cup. So shiny glass slides right out. So a paper cup, easier to hold, or a coated cup, a styrofoam cup. But shiny things slide right out. So, and not being able to sweat means temperature regulation in the body doesn't work so well. So cold and heat have to be taken care of externally, because they don't work so well internally. So meanwhile, I'm learning with him, and the more I learn with him, and the more they cut back his pain medication, he's still recovering. He said it's a 2-year recovery process from the accident. So he's in physical therapy every morning. He learns in the afternoons, and working hard to learn and recover whatever he can recover. And I just see that the more he's working and the more the pain meds are cut back, the greater personality he has. He really loves to learn. And every time I leave, I just have to keep chasing away that thought, like, he is not for my daughter. He's a quadriplegic. Just shut up, internal voice. So, but I go one time, I brought him a muffin, and he said, oh, can't have a muffin. I'm thinking, why not? Like, you ate my food in the hospital. Is it less kosher now? He said, no, it's not about the kosher. He says, so I have to eat like a champion. Every calorie has to count. I can't afford to put on extra weight. So I have to make sure that I maintain a frame that is going to be a healthy weight so that I can move to the best of my ability. And I also see that every half hour, he's looking at his watch, every half hour he pushes his wheelchair back from the table, undoes the Velcro strap that holds him up, because he still doesn't have the core strength. He's gaining it, but he could be a little floppy here. And he leans all the way over for a whole minute and then pushes himself back, and that helps the fluids move through his body. Because since he doesn't move much, the fluids don't move much, and he would be susceptible to skin breaking down and bed sores and then illness from that. So, but he's really careful. I see he's watching his clock, so he's eating carefully, and he's doing his weight shifts and really taking a lot of proactive attention to making his physical situation into one of responsibility and spiritual growth. And the more I see him, the more I really like him. So I start to think, well, what would it be like? This is a girl who's very spiritual, and she's looking for a guy just like this, except for he's a quadriplegic. Maybe I should just at least, like, entertain the thought. Just a drop, I'll run it past her. I don't know, before I can run it past her, I just have to see, like, who's paying for all this medical care? And how long is he expected to live? And can he be a dad? Those are really important questions. So I call my friend, Miriam, the wife of his brother. I said, Miriam, I just have some questions I have to ask you. Can you please find out, like, what is Yoshua's longevity expectation? Who's paying for his medical care? And is there any fertility left? She said, well, I can tell you about the medical care. Turns out that the summer camp that he worked for, the tiny little 12-camper summer camp that he worked for that year, bought workman's comp insurance. So he was injured on the job. He was a camp counselor. So he's covered for life, medically. Huge, because it's millions of dollars, millions. Covered for life. Great. I said, what about the rest? She said, well, I'll ask Sari, her mother-in-law. So I wait a few days. I wait a week. I finally call her back. I said, did you ask? She said, I couldn't ask. I said, I need to know. I'm thinking about a shidduch. I didn't say who. So I'm thinking about a shidduch for him. I need to know, like longevity and fertility. Like, I need to know this. She said, okay, I'll ask. So I wait a day. I wait another few days. I wait a week. I call her back. I said, no. She said, I couldn't ask. So I said, well, she said, well, who are you thinking about? I said, because I was thinking about somebody for him before the accident, and I called her up, and I said, I think, you know, he's a great shidduch, and are you interested? And she said, forget about it. He had an accident. I'm not interested at all. She said, who are you thinking about? I said, well, actually, I'm thinking about Elisheva, who she knows, my eldest daughter. She said, wow. She said, that's actually a very interesting thought. She said, do you think she would even think about it? I said, I don't know. I don't know, even know if I would think about it. I really need to know about longevity and fertility. So she said, well, I can't ask that question. I said, okay, I'm just going to have to call up Sari, his mother, myself, and ask her. So first I said, I'll just run it past Elisheva just because there's no point in calling Sari if Elisheva totally wouldn't think about it. So I called Elisheva and I said, you know that guy you've been davening for, Yoshua Mishulam Ben Saralia, who had the accident? She said, yeah. I said, remember how you said that I should just pick your chassan for you and just let you know who he is? She said, yeah. I said, well, the more I spend time with him, the more I really, really like him, except for he's quadriplegic. What do you think of that? She said, well, what do you really like about him? So I told her some of the things I see, that he really davens with kavana, that he's really using his whole physical experience to transform himself spiritually, which is what I had taught her this whole world is about, is how to use the physical to become more of a spiritual person. And I see that he's doing that in his everyday life. And I also feel like he's really grown tremendously through this. Like, so many 23-year-old guys are just, they're not that mature yet, but this really catapulted him like a whole decade of spiritual growth, you know. He was really on a trajectory, because he was one of the good boys in the mirror. He was on a trajectory for conceit and, you know, and looking down on people and being in that closed, you know, right-wing world. But so this has really opened him up. He's gotten so much care from the very eclectic group of people in Denver, especially his parents' friends. His father is a Karlbachi, Karlbach Musmach. He has smicha, ordination from Rabbi Karlbach. And his mother is also a Torah teacher. Hi. But of the more feminist variety. So he's the right-wing child of his eclectic family. And Elisheva is the right-wing child of her broad-thinking family. So I thought, you know, you both come from similar backgrounds. You both, like, went to the right in your broader-based families. You're both true daveners. You're both really on a path of serving Hashem and making that the central thing in your life. And I feel like he's so genuine and so real. She said, well, what about longevity and fertility? So I need to ask that. I just wanted to ask you first, like, would you even consider it? She said, well, I would consider it, but I really need to know some answers to some questions. So we made a list of questions. And I called up Sari and I said, could you meet with me? She said, okay. So we went to a Starbucks and I said, is Yoshua considering dating at all? She said, dating? He's 6 months out from his accident. No, he's not considering dating. That's a ridiculous question. Of course he's not considering dating. It's a 2-year recovery period. He hasn't even thought of dating. I said, well, I actually have something in mind. I was just thinking, like, maybe it's possible that, you know, this person might be a good match for him. She said, a good match for him? Who were you thinking about? I said, well, it's my daughter, Elisheva. And she just started to cry and cry. When she recovered, we started to talk about why I thought it might be a good idea. And I said, you know, here she has this sense of adventure, which I had written in her shidduch resume, not knowing that it might apply. I said, this is a girl who happens to be physically very strong. When she was 4, I remember I was schlepping in groceries from Costco, and I had bought a 44-pound box of sugar. And she was 4 and 40 pounds, and she carried it in. I turned around, I saw it was in the kitchen. I'm like, how did that get here? She said, I brought it in for you, Ima. And I'm like, it weighs more than you. And she carried it in, and she's always been strong and organized and capable. And I just, you know, it just seemed like, and she was interested in somebody who was genuine and real. Not only that, I said, but she hasn't watched any movies. So she has no clue what it's supposed to be like in a physical relationship, right? Her sense of adventure could be there too. She has no idea of what it should be. She's a blank slate that way. And he is also has been very careful in that kind of thing. Probably not as careful as her because he's a guy, you know, but she had been very careful. I said, so I really think, it's something that we could think about. So, but I said, I just need to know, like, is there any, like, what's the story with his longevity and is there any possibility of fertility? She said, well, he is expected to live into his 70s or 80s, barring a bed sore or something that might complicate matters. So, and I had seen how careful he is with his weight shifts and careful with the skin and bed sore kind of things. So 70, 80. Okay, so that was one of the answers on the questions. And then fertility, she said they don't know for sure, but they do think that there is some fertility diminished, but fertility left. And I asked her the other questions. And I called Elisheva back, and I gave her the answers. And she said, yeah, I am interested. And she said, I've been thinking about it. And she said, these questions, you know, I have a few more questions. So I called her back and I said, do you think you could ask Yoshua if he's interested in dating? She said, I don't know. She said, but I said, well, it's Purim time now. And Elisheva's coming back for Pesach. So that's a month. I said, if I just want them to meet, even if he doesn't want to date, like at least let's check it out. I know he's not ready to get married. It's a 2-year recovery process. You're only 6 months in. But if they could at least meet, then I could, if it's not appropriate, I can cross him off the list and move on. And if it is appropriate, she could wait. I just need to know, like, could you just ask him? So she said, okay, she will. She said, but I'm not going to use a name. I said, good. Don't use a name. Just, you know, say that somebody has suggested a possibility. So she went to him and she said, Yeshua, have you thought about dating yet? He said, what? Dating? No, I'm 6 months out of the accident. Of course I haven't thought of that. She said, well, because a suggestion has been made. He said, a suggestion? Is she frum? Mm-hmm. She said, yeah, she actually is. She said, really? She's really frum? She said, yeah, she really is really frum. He said, and she knows what happened to me? She said, yeah, and she knows about the accident. She knows what happened to you. He said, and she's frum? I said, yeah, she actually is. She said, I don't know. So she told him, well, she's in Israel now, and she's going to be coming back for Passover, and she just wants to meet you just to see if there's anything, and I was just wondering if you would think about it. She says, I don't know. I'll have to talk to my Rebbe. So he calls his Rebbe in Israel, Rabbi Noach Orlowick, who's one of the top rabbis in Israel, who's been giving him a lot of time over these last several months to be able to help him process, especially the death of the camper that was in the van with him, and then really the death of his whole life and the need to create a new life out of who he is now. So he's been working a lot intensely with this rabbi. So he spoke to the rabbi, and the rabbi said, well, if she's frum and appropriate that way, and she's interested, I think it would be important for you to meet her. But I'll tell you what, if she's in Israel now, and I'm in Israel now, how about if I meet her first, and I'll let you know. Okay. So we agreed to that. So he gave his cell phone number to Yoshua, who gave it to his mother, who gave it to me, who gave it to Elisheva, and Elisheva used Rabbi Orlowick's cell phone to call him in Israel to set up an appointment. Now, usually Rabbi Orlowick does 10-minute appointments. He requires that you write your questions out first so that you are not wasting his time formulating your questions. That's the time slots he has. So he gave her a 10-minute appointment, but he really gave her an hour. So she showed up, and they talked, and she had been, you know, really davening about it. Should she? Shouldn't she? She's thinking about it, and she's thinking she trusts her mother and the things that I said, and she just doesn't know. And she's talking to the rabbi about it, and he, after 50 minutes, said to her. He also reads faces, by the way. I had him once in my house for when he gave a lecture in Denver, and I had a question about a child. He said, do you have a picture of them? I showed a family picture, and he looked at the person's face, and he gave me advice that actually worked very well for that child. So I know that he has that skill. He doesn't usually use it for matches, however, but he does use it for parental advice. So after 50 minutes, he said, well, I think it's a good match. She said, so you mean, like, if we meet and we click, then it's a good match, which is what I told her. You have to meet, right, and click. And if you click, then it's good. He said, no, that's not what I mean. What I mean is it's a good match. Don't meet him. unless you're ready to move forward. And then he said, so, do you have any questions for me? She said, well, I don't know. Like, I have a friend. She was sick once, and then she made a match, and then the match almost got broken off because they found out that she was sick, and they had to explain that she was sick once, and she's not sick now. But I learned from that, like, that healthy people don't marry sick people, and it's a different whole match thing, and, like, I'm a healthy girl, and should I even be thinking about a match like this? And he said, well, all I can tell you is that it's a good match, and I love Yehoshua way too much to answer that question for you. You now have to go to a quiet place and think if you could go ahead with this or not. That's up to you. So now she's going to Kever Rachel twice a week and the Kotel every day, right? And davening. She doesn't know what to do, but finally she calls me and she says, yeah, I do. I do want to meet him. So this is a week before Passover, and we're talking about meeting him, and then I get a call from my boss, Chaya Levine, who's here in Denver now, and she called me up. She said, Aliza, you won't believe it. Somebody called me. He's 24 years old. He has a college degree. He's a Balshuva. He's from Australia. But he's really learned, and he's musical. He wants to do Kiruv. He wants to live in out of town, but he already has his degree in accounting so he can earn a living, and he loves Torah, and he's musical, and I just thought of your daughter. So I said, interesting. Well, I'm working on something now, but I'll call her and ask. So I called her up and I said, guess what? Chaya Levine called with the possibility. He's 24 years old and he's into Kiruv and he's really musical and he has a college degree, so he'll be able to earn and he loves to learn. And do you want to meet him? She said, well, I really want to meet Yehoshua. I said, well, how about if this guy's in Israel right now, you can meet this guy in Israel before you leave for Passover. You'll meet him one time and then you'll come back to the States and you'll meet Yehoshua while you're in the States and then you'll have met them both and then you could decide. She said, no. She said, I think I really want to meet Yehoshua first. So I was really glad for that, that there was that was there as like kind of a certifier. She came back and we decided, because I had seen how the dating scene works, one date, people sometimes decide after one date, and I thought, that's just stupid, so stupid. Let's just make it a plan that they are going to date three times. They'll meet three times to decide if they're going to meet a fourth time. That's it. So they both agreed to that. They will meet three times to decide if they'll meet a fourth. And then they stipulated they both hated dating. And the first date is very formal. You have to wear Shabbos clothes. You meet in a hotel lobby. And it's a formal conversation. And they so didn't want to do it. So they decided they're going to start with a second date. So that's more casual attire. You can meet in a coffee place, right? So his mom dresses him up in casual. She gets dressed up in casual, and his mom drives him to a Pete's Coffee, not Starbucks, because that's really the meeting place. You know, it had to be a different place. So at Pete's Coffee, and then his mom leaves, and Elisheva comes in. It was easy to figure out who was the guy she was supposed to meet, you know, because he's the guy with the wheels. So a lot of times in these dating situations where you don't know who it is, sometimes even mismatches are made where, like, there's two Menachems in the lobby and a girl goes over and says, are you Menachem? And he says, yes. And they sit down and they talk and they realize that that was not exactly who was planned at all. But sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, but in this case, it was very easy to identify the right person. And she went over and she put some money on the table and said, I can't get you a drink, but here's some money. You could get one for yourself. So he just wanted to put it on the table immediately. He can't take care of her. So off she went. She got a drink. She came back. She sat down. They chatted. She came back after the first date. And even though he had said they're going to go out three times to decide if they're going to go out a fourth, and there's no pressure, still everybody wanted to know instantly, what did she think? Yeah. Right? So her siblings surrounded her. I fended them off, and I said, no, you're not allowed to ask three times before we're discussing it. She went upstairs. I followed and asked. Okay, so what did you think? How was it? So she said it was the easiest date she ever went on in her entire life. It was so easy to talk to him. She really enjoyed it, and she was looking forward to the next one. So the next one, they decided to go to a pottery studio where you paint your own pottery. So this is a guy who cannot hold a paintbrush, right? But they met at the pottery studio. He put on a special assistive cuff that allowed him to hold a paintbrush. They painted their pottery. It was a short date because, you know, sometimes these dates are 4 or 6 hours long. I heard of one date in the mountains. We live near the mountains, so that's a classic date to drive into the mountains and drive back, where they drove into the mountains. They were chatting, and on the way back, they were so tired. The guy was like, only the man knew how to drive. The girl didn't. And he was so tired, he couldn't, like, see straight. He said, do you mind if we just pull over for a few minutes? Because, it was just much longer than they expected, and he couldn't, like, drive safely. He said, I just need to rest for, like, 10 minutes. He put a seat back. They both fell asleep in the car till the morning, and they had to drive home in the morning. Right. So sometimes these dates are long. Sometimes they have embarrassing ends, even if nothing embarrassing happened. But anyway, their dates were short because Yoshua still was recovering, and he had very little physical reserves. So the dates were about an hour each, but the second date went great, and for the third date, they went on a picnic, and they definitely decided they wanted a fourth. Now I wasn't sure what to do because, you know, it was already past the Seders, and it's the middle of Passover, and now we have to decide, like, am I going to extend her ticket? How long will they need to date? Now I kind of need more feedback than it was just nice. So they plan a fifth date and come back, and I call Yoshua, and I said, you know, take your time, as much time as you need, but I just need to know, should I change the ticket or not? So now that night, after the fifth date, I was walking in the hallway, and I hear the two sisters on the bed. Now, I'm not a Snoopy mom. However, when I was in the hallway and I heard the two girls talking, and the one sister asked Elisheva, so if he asked you, what would you say? I couldn't just pass the room. I had to just stop and listen, right? So I just paused right there to hear, I would say yes. So, I forgot to say that after the third date, because it was going well, Sari said, okay, three dates is very nice, but this is serious business. You have no clue what it's like to get him through a day. You just see him dressed up nicely. I drop him off. You come get him. And, you know, you need to know a little bit more. So she called Elisheva and me to a meeting in Starbucks. And she went through a whole day. What is it like? And Elisheva said, that sounds okay to me. That's fine. Okay. That's fine. Everything that she said, she was fine with. And, he does have a tech that comes twice a day so that private things can be kept private. But still, there's a lot that the person who lives with him would have to take care of. And Elisheva heard it all and was fine. And so for the third date, she came to the house instead of meeting him somewhere and picked him up in the special van so that she could have practiced driving the van and seeing what it would be like to strap him in and maneuver it and all that stuff. So she was practicing with that, and she was really enjoying her time with him. She really felt like he was a great guy. So by the fifth date, I just needed to know. I didn't want to put pressure, but, you know, it's five dates already. So I called him. I said, take as much time as you want. I just need to know. Do you want more time? Should I delay her ticket? Or do you know? If you know it's a no, I don't have to change the ticket. If you know it's a yes, I could change the ticket depending on what you want. Just let me know. Change the ticket or not. He said, well, how do you think she's feeling? I said, well, I think she's feeling pretty positively. So he said, well, then you don't have to change the ticket. So I knew that the next date they were going to get engaged, right? So I told my daughter-in-law, Gitti. So my second child got married first. He married somebody, a Hasidish girl from Muncie. That was a whole other story. But anyway, she's from a lapsed Hasidish family, but she's the authority on things Jewish. So, and a romantic. So I told her, and full of energy. So I told her, you know, like, things are going great. She's like, I know! So, and I said, you know, and I think tomorrow is, you know, things are going really well. I think they're going to get engaged. I think he's going to ask her. I think tomorrow he's going to ask her. And she said, you know what that means, don't you? I said, yes, I do. It means they're going to get engaged. She said, no, it means you have to make a l'chaim. I said, it does? She said, yes, you have to make a l'chaim. She's like, you have to call him and ask him who he wants to be there for a l'chaim. I said, I do? She said, yes, you do. So I called him up. I said, Yoshua, if by any chance tomorrow there might be a mazel tov, who would you want to be in our house to greet you for that mazel tov? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, Gitti said I have to call you and ask you. He said, oh, Gitti said, okay, well, here's the list. So he gave me the list. Okay, so now I call people the next day, and I say, in case There's a mazel tov today. No, I just said, in case we need you today, at 5 o'clock, could you please clear your schedule? So they know the Jewish world, so they said yes. I didn't say what. I just said, if I need you at 5, please be available. Okay, fine. So I asked the Rosh Hashivas and his different teachers. Okay, so meanwhile, she drives off, and now we go into high gear because we know there's going to be a l'chaim. She had no clue, right? Fortunately for us, it's the middle of Pesach, so nobody eats in other houses on Passover. So we knew all we had to put out was wine, clementines, and grapes, and we're done. No baking, no anything else, because just what everybody can eat. That's it. So we put out the wine, but we decorated the house. You know, we had hearts all around and balloons and pink and white and, you know, put the wine glasses in a stack and sprinkle petals and, like, you know, had it all ready. So, and then we're waiting and we're waiting and we're biting our nails and we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And finally the call comes and everybody starts to scream. Mazel tov, they're all so excited. And I make the other phone calls and I say, 5 o'clock is the time, so could you please be here? And I tell them, be back at 5 o'clock, and okay. So now there's the big mazel tov, right? So now, the story gets different. So in his world, it goes around the world in a flash. Mazel tov, Yeshua is engaged. It's so fabulous. Who would have thought? That's so great. He's alive. He's engaged. He's getting married into who? Elisheva Bula. What a great match. It's so fabulous. The families go well together. This is great. Right? And the word goes around Elisheva. Wow, Elisheva is engaged. To who? To Yeshua Hoffman? Are you kidding? But he's handicapped. What are they thinking? Can you believe it? Engaged to Yeshua? Really? Wow. So then the conversation starts to come back. First, a lot of back channel conversation to my married son. Didn't your mother realize he's handicapped? What is she thinking? I'm like, I didn't really think of that. And I was trying to think, what could be the responses? You know, like when people would say something like that. Like I was thinking, you know, so many times you meet people and they say something you wish, oh, I should have said. So we kept talking about what we should have said. And so if somebody would say, don't you know he's handicapped? I could say, he is? Right. So I was thinking, okay, that would be good, but I didn't get a chance to use that one. And then people ask all kinds of private questions, you know, how are they going to have the kids? I'm like, really? Is this what you ask most brides and grooms, how they're going to have kids? Like, I think they'll figure that out. I don't think that's really your business, right? That's up to them how that's going to happen, right? And then one person, I'm walking back from shul with the person who's really beautiful, a woman who's very physically beautiful, and her husband is really handsome. And they have a terrible marriage. And I know, because she's come to me many times about this marriage. And it's a rotten marriage, but they're both really cute. Right? So we're walking back from shul.
It all matters.
We're walking back from shul, and she says, you know, I really get it, this shidduch that you made. I totally understand it. She said, you know, we were matched because we're both good looking. But you know we don't get along. She says, now I've been married long enough that I see that to be married to somebody that you can really talk to, it would really be great. I totally understand what you're doing. I said, you do? That is so nice. I can't even tell you. I really appreciate you telling me that, because so many people are asking me what's wrong with Elisheva that I would think of a match like this. She said, I know. I can't believe people would ask that. Nothing is, right? Really? So finally, somebody came over to me, and I was getting used to answering these questions, and I had done a lot of thinking about what I should say. And somebody came over to me and said, will they be able to lead a normal life? I said, no, they won't. And that is the whole point. They don't want to be normal. They want to be extraordinary. They want to have an extraordinary life, which is why they chose each other, two souls, to build an extraordinary life together. And they'll have to deal with whatever the physical offers them. But they understand that the physical is about a tool set to become extraordinary spiritual beings. And that's what they want. And that's what they're going to build together. So I tell this story for you to hear that becoming extraordinary is your choice. You can choose whether it's through a shidduch, whether it's through your own life, whether it's through your parenting, whether it's through your friendships, to use the physical in a way that it's a toolbox for your spiritual development. Becoming extraordinary is a mindset, and it is the gift of all Jews, the realm of all of us, to step out of the ordinary and become absolutely extraordinary. That's who we are. It's a people of extraordinary means with extraordinary contributions to make. So I invite you all to step into the extraordinary. And you can ask any question. Oh, wait, I have pictures. Hang on.